Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to convene the program. Keep eating your dessert and drinking your coffee. I'm used to talking while people are eating, and I think Dr. Gratzer is too. On behalf of the Manhattan Institute, welcome to this luncheon, this program. You're in for a treat this afternoon. You're in for a treat about a subject that is about 1/6 of the nation's economy, a subject that, according to some polls, is one of the country's biggest worries, healthcare, and also a treat about a subject that in other ways is the nation's biggest asset, the talent we have in medicine and biomedical science that can produce excellence and innovation in medicine. This treat's going to be presented to you by an expert who has taken the time and who clearly has the insight to write a wonderful book. I hope you will steal the copy on your table or buy one or two. It is a really wonderful book. It combines a number of extraordinary qualities. To begin with, it's clear, with a lot of writing on this subject isn't. It's got a lot of specifics, real cases presented with wit and clarity. It has sweep of all of the issues involved in this subject, and there are quite a few. It's quantitative, which appeals to me, the physicist in me, quantitative where essential. There's very key data about all of the important trends in this book. It's conceptual, pros and cons on all the issues. David is quite fair to all points of view, and in a historically informed way. He doesn't blame anybody in particular for where we've got to. Most of the intentions were good. And it is, as you'll see when you read the book, Milton Friedman writes a wonderful little foreword. It's economically literate, which not all physicians are. It's socially aware, as most good physicians are. It's sensitive to the needs of everybody in our society, not just the people who have a lot of money. And in short, the book is trying to match the excellence that at our best is in our economic system, as I said, to the social needs and goals. I'm reminded of a wonderful remark by the painter Edgar Degas. He once said, "Painting is easy when you don't know how, but very difficult when you do." Many would-be healthcare reformers think it's easy. Dr. Gratzer may be the Degas of repainting the U.S. healthcare system because he knows the difficulty. Let me just take an extra minute to give you one example that was a real wake-up call for me in the book. There's a chapter about Medicaid, which most of the people in this room, I suspect, don't think about much. It's under our radars. It's a kind of a sleeper issue. The spending on Medicaid in 1970 was about $5 billion. 35 years later, 2005, it was $330 billion, growing from $5 to $330 billion. The defense budget is a little more than $400 billion. So Medicaid alone is almost equal to the defense budget. Nationally, we spend more on Medicaid, I learned from David's book, than we do on K-12 education. And we think K-12 education is a pretty big expenditure. There is also, of course, in this book, a sweeping analysis of Medicare, which is a larger problem and a rapidly growing problem. These expenditures have produced distortions and effects that no one intended and large vested interests. David's study has great depth, and I hope it will lead to application of his recommendations, which I think he will dwell on this afternoon. But I do recall the remark of Dr. Johnson, and I'm afraid we're going to run into this. Johnson said, "Nothing will ever be attempted if all possible objections must first be overcome." There will be objections to every single one of Dr. Gratzer's recommendations. We'll need a lot of effort to execute well. Dr. Gratzer is a physician, a psychiatrist from Canada. He authored a pioneering book in Canada about their healthcare system called Code Blue in 1999, which made him famous in Canada. He says occasionally he scandalized people. He's active professionally and in many public interviews. I was delighted to see in his resume that he's married and is, quote, the proud father of a baby girl. Join me in welcoming Dr. David Gratzer.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction. Thank you as well, Rod, for your help as I was writing this book and for the generosity of your time in helping explain to me some aspects of drug regulation. This is, as many of you know, the book launch, the first of a series of events, and it's here in New York, hosted, of course, by my think tank, the Manhattan Institute. I acknowledge many people in the book, but I just wanted to thank again the good people at the Manhattan Institute for giving me the opportunity to do this project. I'm particularly grateful to a handful of people, too numerous to name, Samara, Lindsay, Michael. There are three people in particular I highlight in the acknowledgments, and I just want to make mention of. I want to thank David DeRozier for convincing me to start this project. I want to thank Henry Olson for convincing me that I could finish this project. And I want to thank Mark Riebling for ensuring that I did. I also want to thank Larry Mohn, who is the president of the Manhattan Institute, showed great support of me, and I'm most grateful for that. This is also the first event in a series of many events, and I'm very pleased that my parents could be here. You can talk to them later and explore facets of my childhood. They're here for this important event, as they have been for every major important event of my life, and of course, I'm very grateful that my wife is here. She is my pillar, my rock. Thank you very much for joining us today. Healthcare is personal. Let me start with a personal story. It was a half-inch incision, a 28-minute procedure. It was a small medical miracle, and at the end, we got a foot-and-a-half-long bill that, as a doctor, I couldn't understand. That was my wife's experience with healthcare in America. Just before we got married, I was invited to speak at a conference in the mountains. I'm a prairie kid. The mountains are pretty exciting to me, and I thought, wow, what an inexpensive ski trip. Well, this is the most expensive, inexpensive ski trip of my life. The hotel was covered, the ticket for the plane was covered, and most unfortunately, the hospital bill was not. My wife is here. She tells a slightly different version of this event. Basically, she was on the bunny hill and ruptured a disc in her back. She explains it slightly differently. It involves a mountain, gale-like winds at 70 miles an hour. But at the end of the day, this much was clear. She had a major back injury. We needed surgery. How to find a neurosurgeon? It wasn't just the bill, ultimately, that bothered me. It was also just the lack of information. How to find a neurosurgeon in West New York? I started cold calling neurologists for their professional opinion about neurosurgeons. We finally found a neurosurgeon who seemed competent enough, and then he gave us a choice of two hospitals. I knew nothing on either of the hospitals. We decided, after a significant internet search for data, to pick a hospital because the name sounded better. The night before the procedure, we stayed at a lovely Hampton Inn in Buffalo, what I had selected on hotels.com. I had perfect information. It had a rating system on hotels.com. Expedia does the same, Orbitz does the same. And I knew exactly what to expect, right down to the fact that they had an outdoor pool. I knew the price and everything of the sort. The mundane choice, which was so unimportant, I was so well informed on. The major choice, which could color the rest of our lives, I knew practically nothing about. And, of course, then there was the issue about the bill. Foot-and-a-half-long bill, inscrutable, and for an extraordinary sum of money. I couldn't believe how much money. I called up the hospital administrator and asked if there were some mistake, and she said, oh, don't be too concerned. This is just a starting point of negotiations. Before we got into negotiating, I started getting terse letters from collection agencies. I called them up and I said, look, why can't we settle this out? I'll give you 10% over the Medicare list price. What's the Medicare list price? And she said, I can't give you that. It's confidential. Everyone I know has a story like this, not necessarily involving yourself or your wife, not necessarily involving skiing, but involving American healthcare. The ever-rising prices, the inscrutable bills, the uneven quality, the mystery of it all. That is, of course, what's going on at the micro level, but at the macro level, so many things are changing, and not necessarily for the better. Just talking about cost, as you know, health insurance premiums have more than doubled since the year 2000. As you're well aware, Medicaid is now the highest state expenditure, higher, incidentally, than K-12 education, and, of course, Medicare taxes the federal treasury. This is a big issue, and it seems, to some at least, completely unresolvable, which is why, a dozen years after Hillary Care, people have again started to talk about some type of a government solution. The LA Times wistfully opined that things might have been better with Hillary Care recently. California legislatures actually recently passed legislation, vetoed by the governor, though, calling for a single-payer system. Many people are looking to some sort of a government solution, not me. The biggest lesson I learned in medical school wasn't in the classroom, it was on the way to the classroom. I grew up in Winnipeg, which is smack dab in the middle of Canada. It's a city roughly the size of Indianapolis. I went to medical school there. Winnipeg, on a cold winter's day, can actually drop to 40 below. For you trivia buffs, that's actually the same in Celsius as it is in Fahrenheit. It's that cold. Winnipeggers are a hardy lot. And, of course, all parkades are outdoors. And I was walking to the classroom and outdoors, and I wanted just to shave a minute off my commute time. So I cut across the ER of the hospital. And I walked in on this very cold February morning and discovered the crisis in emergency room care that was plaguing Canadian hospitals at the time. And I just walked in, and there was a room filled with elderly people on stretchers, some of them waiting 3, 4, 5 days for a bed. And the smell hit me, the smell of urine and of sweat and of fear. And at that moment, I realized that what was going on with Canadian healthcare was very different than I had previously assumed. Look, I don't want to overstate my case here. I wanted to be a doctor when I was a kid and as an adolescent. I hadn't given a lot of thought to health policy, okay? That came later. But when I was growing up, I absorbed certain things from my environment. I absorbed a belief that ice hockey is the most fascinating sport. I absorbed an ability to convert Fahrenheit into Celsius in my head. And I absorbed the fundamental belief that if the government does it when it comes to healthcare, it must be compassionate, it must be fair. And in that morning, I began to rethink things. The debate in Canada at the time was divided between the spendthrifts and the magicians, an acknowledgement that there was a problem, but there was going to be some type of a government solution. And that could be spending more money, the spendthrifts, or it could be just hiring better administrators, the magicians. And when I stepped in that ER, I started to think about it, and I became a spendthrift, and then I became a magician, and ultimately I became agnostic and then atheist in my health philosophy. And the reason is simple enough. I spent enough time in those hospitals seeing people waiting for the care they needed to recognize something was fundamentally wrong. The gentleman who had a simple hernia repair and a nerve fiber got trapped and he was in pain and he was referred to a pain clinic with a 2-year wait list. The gentleman with sleep apnea who just needed to go to a sleep disorders clinic except they had a 3-year wait list. Talk about some other stories in the book. Got me thinking about these things, and I started to write on the issue. Started to think that there was a fundamental problem with government-based healthcare, that everything was free, but nothing was readily available. It was like the old Soviet system, except it's kind of funny to talk about toilet tissue in Moscow in 1976, and much less funny to talk about radiation therapy in Toronto in 2006. Well, there's only so much you can say in 700 words, so I decided to write a book about this. I told my parents. They were very supportive. I don't think anyone actually thought I would finish the book, but I did, and then I started to send it out to different publishing houses. I got 13 letters of rejection from 12 publishing houses. An academic publishing house lost my sample chapters, rejected the book based on the proposal, then they found the sample chapters, realized it was just as bad as they had suspected, and sent me another letter of rejection. And the book got a little bit of attention. In fact, it went on to win a prize. And I watched very quickly how much sentiment changed in Canada. Hey, maybe even I had a little bit to do with that. Today in Canada, by the way, a private clinic opens up at the rate about once a week. One of the foremost critics of Canadian healthcare has just been elected, the president-elect of the Canadian Medical Association. The Supreme Court of Canada recently said that access to waiting lists is not access to healthcare and struck down several key laws, arguing that it violated Quebec constitutional law. Things are changing in Canada, and like I said, maybe even I had a hand to play in it. And yet, like many Canadians, I see my future not north of the 49th parallel, but south of the 49th parallel. I'm licensed in the United States. And yet when I look at these issues, I see Americans going down a similar disastrous path that people in Canada have previously. That's why I wrote the book. Let's talk about American healthcare for a few minutes, shall we? Here is my ultimate conclusion. American healthcare is so feverishly expensive because it's so darn cheap. Americans aren't underinsured for healthcare, they're overinsured. Let me explain to you how I came to those conclusions. I can explain to you all of American healthcare, incidentally, by citing four dates, two men, and one organ. Let's start with the first date. February 12, 1941. Trivia buffs amongst us, what's significant about that date?
Penicillin?
First clinical use of penicillin. You win the Door Prize. We like to think of healthcare, we like to think of medicine as this ancient tradition. Doctors absolutely love to talk in those terms. The Hippocratic Oath goes back to the days of Hippocrates. All of what we do as doctors is thoroughly modern, okay? And I don't mean modern as in within the last 500 years. I mean what you really understand of medicine, MRI machines, emergency medicine, antidepressants. This came about not in the last 500 years, but in the last 60 years. And it starts with the first clinical use of penicillin. That use starts with a gentleman by the name of Alexander Albert. He's a police officer in Britain, and he reaches down to pick a letter he's dropped off the ground, and he scrapes his face on a rose bush. Within a few days, he is literally dying of a basic infection. His face is swollen. He's about to be sent to the septic ward of your local hospital. We don't have septic wards anymore. It's where you go to die of infections. And they start giving him penicillin, and the first day nothing happens, and the second day nothing happens, and then the third day his fever breaks. By day four, he's out of his bed eating. If we had done nothing else in the 20th century but discover penicillin, I still think it would have been the century of medicine. But on that day, the era of modern medicine begins, and the discoveries and the clinical applications thereof are unbelievable. Steroids, antidepressants, antipsychotics, some examples of the dramatic change that have gone on. Well, let me give you that example of that one individual. Anyone happen to know who Dick Cheney is? He holds a high office. Some of you passionately love Dick Cheney, some of you don't. Forget about the man, forget about his politics. Let's focus in solely on his heart. Anyone happen to know if he has any trouble with his heart? He's had a few heart attacks. Anyone care to place a number on that? Four. Somebody in the back muttered five. Sometimes I've gone to these conferences and we've had bidding wars. Some guy bid 10 and then looked around if he gets the Door Prize, but we already gave it away. He's had four heart attacks. Now, I'm not a cardiologist. I'm just a psychiatrist. Your average cardiologist has 15 years of higher education. Let me, though, summarize some very sophisticated medical science in just a few simple principles. As a general rule of thumb, and again, if there is a cardiologist here, interrupt me if I've gotten this wrong, three heart attacks is better than four. As a general rule of thumb, two is better than three, and one is better than two. And as I understand it, again, I'm very simplistic. I'm just a shrink. Not having had a heart attack is probably better than having had a heart attack. And yet Dick Cheney has had four, and he's not only able to walk up a flight of stairs, he's able to hold down full-time employment. That is modern medicine at its very best. It is also a thoroughly modern revelation. General Robert E. Lee had a heart attack on the battlefield in 1863. He called for the army physician. They immediately diagnosed it, and they suggested to him he was having a heart attack. What was state-of-the-art cardiac care in 1863? Bed rest. Anyone know how long? Somebody says forever. 2 weeks, okay? Winston Churchill, shortly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, gives a rousing address to the joint session of Congress. Then he sits on a train going to Ottawa where they take his famous photo, the Karsh photo, and he gives an almost equally arousing address before Parliament. He tries to open the window in the train. He gets chest pain, migrates to the left. What's going on with him? He's having a heart attack. What is state-of-the-art cardiac care essentially after, roughly a century after General Robert E. Lee has had his heart attack? Bed rest. How long? 6 weeks. That's medical progress for a century. Okay? Today, cardiovascular disease, death by cardiovascular disease has dropped by two-thirds in the last 50 years. Beta blockers alone reduce cardiac mortality by over 50%. I pick cardiology because it's easy to talk about that field, and one can palpably feel how impressive the results are. Just as one final example, 88% of people who are 65 or under who have had a heart attack return to their cause their work. It's just amazing what's gone on there, but everywhere. I mean, psychiatry, antipsychotics were discovered and invented in 1958. It's transformed the field. One could pick a variety of other areas. Medicine is much better, and that's where people usually stop. They say we've got a crisis in America with healthcare because medicine is better. Sure, well, you pay more, but you get more for it. Just as one example, the pacemaker in Dick Cheney's chest is a very sophisticated pacemaker. It's got a defibrillator attached to it. That pacemaker costs 50 times more than the spending of the average American in 1970. So we spend more, we get more for it. I don't buy that. In fact, I would point out that in every other field in our economy, every other sector of our economy, advancement in science is accommodated by a fall in prices. Don't believe me? Think about the computer on your desk. Isn't it much better than it was 20 years ago? Isn't it much faster, much more sophisticated? Isn't it much cheaper? Why is it, though, healthcare keeps going up in cost? I mean, you can argue medicine is better, but is medicine really twice as good as it was just 5 years ago? So what's going on with medicine? Two dates you need to know to understand how we got here. October 26, 1943, and December 1, 1942. Those two dates color American health insurance. What happened on October 26, 1943 that was such a revolutionary event? Actually, Congress didn't pass any legislation. In fact, the Supreme Court didn't rule on any cases. The IRS made a tax ruling. As you know, during the Second World War, there was wage and price controls. Well, we all have heard the stories or have lived through the consequences of price controls. Your aunt talking about butter being rationed and the like, the queues for gasoline. Wage controls, though, had a peculiar effect as well. Companies wanted to hire better staff, but couldn't raise wages. And so they started to offer benefits, in particular health benefits that they had never offered before really in large numbers. And in October 26, 1943, the IRS ruled that health insurance premiums could now be paid or could continue to be paid in pre-tax dollars. And that gets codified in 1954. And that changes everything because all of a sudden employers have discovered a great way of giving employees a raise without having to worry about taxation. Good deal for employers, but particularly good deal for employees. What do I mean? Let me give you one example. You run a company. You want to give your top managers a $1,000 raise. Depending on what the tax marginal tax rate was, they might walk home with $600, maybe even $500 in their pocket. But you give them $1,000 more worth of health insurance benefits, they could potentially walk home with $1,000 more in perks. And that is why employers got in the game of providing health insurance. Many economists I talked to as I was writing this book said, well, that's just the natural order of things. There's nothing natural about that. Your employer doesn't provide you with food, clothing, or shelter, not directly anyway. Why would they be in the health insurance game? Because of wage and price controls in the Second World War. The second event is December 1, 1942, when Lord Beveridge issues his report in Britain, not here, across the pond, so to speak, and he contemplates government's role in healthcare, and he basically says that government ought to provide $0 insurance. Lord Beveridge is an enormously charming individual. He comes to North America, gives a speaking tour, impresses FDR and Truman, and impresses many members of the Democratic Party who eventually push for that type of health insurance. Well, they don't get it for all Americans, but it gives rise, I think, to the philosophy behind Medicare and Medicaid. And between those two dates, you have shocking similarities between private insurance and public insurance, which is to say that Americans are overinsured, that when it comes to simple expenses, we pay very little out of pocket. For every dollar spent on health care in the United States, 14 cents comes out of pocket. Now imagine what it would be like if when you went to the grocery store, if your employer was covering 86 cents on the buck. Certainly, you'd never leave with a half-empty cart. Or, you know, if your employer said he would provide you with an apartment. Three bedrooms, my goodness me. Stifling. Everyone should have four or five bedrooms. And that is the problem that grows with American healthcare. And as medicine grows more sophisticated, healthcare grows more expensive. There are two men who push along this trend. Wilbur Mills, who I think is the great force behind Medicare and Medicaid. Everyone gives LBJ credit, but it is Wilbur Mills who gets it through Congress, and he provides the Democratic idea, government expansion. Richard Nixon isn't quite sure what to do about this. In 1969, he uses the C word for the first time. Crisis. He comes up with a national health initiative. And what is that? We will turn over health decisions to managed care, HMOs. Previously, a West Coast thing, suddenly the very core of Republican ideas, and gives rise to the HMO Act of 1973. And for the last 30 years, we've really had a duel between two competing ideas. Either government bureaucrats should make decisions for you, or HMO bureaucrats should make decisions for you. Well, a lot of this has now fallen by the wayside, and we're like the former Soviet client states, where the Berlin Wall has fallen. We know what we don't want, but we're not quite sure how to proceed. That, my friends, though, is coming to a head, because this is the other date you need to bear in mind if you want to understand American health policy. January 1, 2013, just 7 short years away, not 70 years away, not 17 years away, just 7 years. That is when all of what we know about American health care will change if it hasn't already. I mentioned before how much we spend on American health care. Our expenses between now and then, just 7 years away, will rise from $2 trillion to $4 trillion. It'll double. As a percentage of GDP, it'll rise from 16% to 21%. The person who made this argument to me, by the way, recently was Tommy Thompson, the former Secretary of Health and Human Services. Previously, I thought we'd hit the wall around 2020, but he reined in my unbridled optimism. I could throw in a third argument that the Secretary had made mention of, which is that Medicare starts drawing from the Treasury in 2013 instead of taking money out. So here we are in a real fix. You think companies today have trouble providing health benefits? You haven't seen anything yet. You as an employee are fretting the fact that while wages are up, your real income is actually down as a result of health benefits. You haven't seen anything yet either. And you government officials amongst us who think Medicare and Medicaid are issues, boy, wait and see. I can really come up with only three basic ideas, and we're going to have to choose in the United States which idea to employ. Okay? You're a very smart group. If you can come up with other ideas, I'll add it to the list. Okay? Three ideas for saving American healthcare. Idea number one, back to HMOs. Okay? Sympathy for the devil. We actually did manage costs in the mid-1990s. Health spending only grew by 2% in 1996. That's not bad. Maybe we should try managed care again. Idea number two, well, why don't we socialize healthcare like we've done in every other Western country in the world? And idea number three, capitalism. Okay? I don't think managed care works well with American values. It's overly paternalistic, and I think the reasons why it failed in the mid-1990s, late 1990s, is the reason it won't work today. Socialized medicine, well, you already know my views on socialized medicine, but I don't think that rationing care of the sick and the elderly is a particularly American approach to this problem. The only idea I've got left, then, is we do something that we haven't done for the last 60 years when it comes to health policy. We try market reforms. Now look, it seems absurd to make that comment. In the other 5/6 of the economy, that's all we do is talk about private sector reforms. And yet in healthcare, as I pointed out before, we've meddled with the tax code. We've let a million regulations bloom. We've let Medicaid rolls grow and expanded Medicare. And the end result is you have a quasi-socialist system, high in cost, satisfactory to no one. So what would be a capitalist agenda for American healthcare? Well, I talk about a variety of things we could do in the book. Let me just outline 5 simple ideas, okay? Idea number one, health insurance ought to be more like every other type of insurance. As I've mentioned before, we're overinsured. Car insurance covers you in the case of an accident. One would never want car insurance that covered you in times of nicks and scratches or when your tank of gas was running low. Insurance doesn't work like that, right? Insurance is supposed to cover you in times of risk and unlikely scenarios. I think Congress took an important, if tentative, first step with health savings accounts, but I talk about my book taking it further, loosening the structure of HSAs, expanding the experiment, leveling the tax playing field, and making it easier for you to buy health insurance that is really insurance. The second idea, foster competition. Again, it seems odd to stand before a group of Americans and talk about the importance of competition. In the other five-sixths of the economy, we intuitively understand that. And yet, when it comes to healthcare, not only are we opposed to competition, we're bullishly in favor of regulations. Let me just give you one example. Right now, if I decided to buy a health insurance plan here in New York State, I would pay four times more than I would pay in Connecticut for the exact same plan from the exact same company. What is the difference between the New York State plan and the Connecticut plan? Well, a sea of New York State regulations. We need to deregulate, make it easier to buy health insurance, make it easier for you to have choice when you buy health insurance, and we need to apply those laws to other aspects of healthcare, like the fact that you can't open a hospital in New York State unless you convince a government committee that you have a good idea with certification of need laws. We need to reconsider all of that. Medicaid, fastest growing government program when it comes to health care. We need to use welfare reform as a model. It's the 10th anniversary of welfare reform this year. Poverty rates are lower than they have been in four decades. That was a success. But welfare and Medicaid have a lot in common, in part because neither program was owned initially by either the federal government or the state government, and as a result, they were mismanaged. What to do about Medicaid? I'd turn it over to the states and let them experiment. We had Wisconsin leading America when it came to welfare reform. Let's see who can lead us when it comes to Medicaid reform. My fourth point, we've got to revisit Medicare. Seems strange to say that when we spent so much time on the last legislation, but we haven't even begun to look at Medicare. The unfunded liability of Medicare is four times greater than the unfunded liability of Social Security. I thought the debate was further ahead in the late 1990s when a bipartisan commission suggested that we could look at the Federal Employees Health Benefits Plan, a menu of private insurance options, and that would be a starting point of reforming Medicare. I agree. Time now is to experiment with that. And the fifth point I'd make is we should address prescription drug prices by reconsidering the size and scope of the FDA. It now costs nearly $1 billion to bring a drug to market. About 40% of that is meeting FDA standards. Again, I think the FDA tries to do good things, but sometimes kindness can kill you, and I think that's very clear in pharmaceutical development and pricing of pharmaceuticals. That's it. I talk in my book about a few more ideas, about seriously reconsidering Medicare, about portability in health insurance, which you'll never have with an employer-based health insurance system, about fostering medical innovation. But ultimately, I think this five-point plan is what we need to really move forward, to avoid the disaster of 2013. Now, I make mention of this to different groups, and people come back and say, my goodness me, these are good ideas, or they're not good ideas, but it doesn't matter because it'll never happen. Right now in Washington, there's such gridlock that they spent an entire year debating whether or not they were going to cut Medicaid growth from 7.7% a year to 7.5% a year, and in fact, Congress couldn't really agree and went with 7.7. But pause for a moment and consider the incredible advances that have occurred in American medicine in the last 60 years. Polio is confined to the history books. Childhood leukemia is eminently treatable. Depression is no longer a purgatory, but treatable as well. We've done so much with American medicine, and we can do so much more. Surely, if we can resolve the polio epidemic, we can put a little bit of market competition back into healthcare. And that, my friends, is what my book is about. We have some time for questions. I might even provide answers. The only request we make is if you could speak into the microphones.
In terms of the regulatory burden that you spoke to, the various states causing New York to have a higher premium than Connecticut, what stands in the way of eliminating that so that you have national competition?
That's something I've promoted before. Congressman Shadegg, in fact, drafted the Healthcare Choice Act. And what he said was, look, New York State wants to have heavy regulations with health insurance. That's fine. But you as a consumer ought to be allowed to shop out of state. So just as you shop out of state for mortgages, you can shop out of state for health insurance. So you as a New Yorker can get that extra safe New York State policy, but you could also go out of state to Iowa, where incidentally you can get a policy for about a third as much as it is today here. I think that's great. I think we should have more competition. I even testified before Congress on the idea. But again, when it gets bogged down in the gridlock of Washington, didn't even make it to a House vote. Why? Who opposed it? Ironically enough, a lot of congressmen from New York and New Jersey, Republicans and Democrats. Why did they oppose that? Oh, I don't know. I would call my congressman if I were in your shoes.
Doctor, after having written the book that puts you on a little bit of a different perspective, overseeing the entire healthcare system, where would you say from your perspective it's headed? Which way is it leaning?
Can of those three choices, managed care, government-run healthcare, or choice and competition, I'm really not sure. I don't know how this debate is going to work out in the end. I know that there's huge pressure on the system, on the employer end, on the employee end. I know that some in the corporate world have begun to talk again about government-run healthcare. I know that some in Washington have talked more about health savings accounts and reforms along those lines. I don't know where this debate is going to end up. Goodness, if I could predict the future, I probably wouldn't be here today. But I do know where we should end up, and I think that's why a roadmap is so important.
What would you say to critics who say that very poor people would make decisions that would not benefit their long-term health in a privatized system?
Sure. First of all, I'm not advocating a full privatized system. I'm not suggesting we overturn Medicare or Medicaid, okay? I am suggesting, though, that there's room to move. I mean, as Rod pointed out, Medicaid is the great sleeper issue. It's risen in terms of expenses from $5 billion a year to $300 billion a year. Medicaid spending is rising at 7.7% annualized and projected to do so for the next 10 years. Lots of numbers to say the same thing. It's a real expense. But as I pointed out before, part of the problem is people in Medicaid are overinsured. It's a paternalistic system. And historically, the way we've attempted to deal with that is pretty simple, wage and price controls, right? You as a Medicaid recipient can go see any doctor you want, but we're going to pay him far less than private insurance, which is why a lot of doctors refuse Medicaid patients. What would I suggest to you is ways around that? Again, I think we have to resolve the ownership issue. Part of the problem is that the federal government ponies up a dollar for 57 cents of every Medicaid dollar. So if you're a governor of a state, there's a lot of incentive for you to expand Medicaid, which is why Medicaid rolls have grown 60% in the last 5 years. New York always does things, I think, a little bit worse than other states. So here, as you know, is not just the federal government and the state governments that are involved in this program, but the county governments, which is why New York's spending on Medicaid exceeds that of California and Texas combined. Where do we move from here? Well, look, one has to be smart about these things. If people can barely afford food, clothing, and shelter, you can't turn around and say, here's a $5,000 deductible. But I do think that there's some ideas percolating in the states to move away from top-down insurance. In Florida, people in two counties now will select amongst private insurance options. If they pick a cheaper plan, they get a certain amount of money in a flexible spending account so they can spend it on prescription drugs. Interesting experiment. In South Carolina, they haven't started this. Florida started September 1. But South Carolina, they're looking at actually creating a small modified health savings account for people on Medicaid. So for the big ticket items, you're covered. And for the smaller stuff, you'll pay out of this health savings account. I don't know quite what the answer is for Medicaid, okay? I'd also point out that Medicaid is even more complicated than this because there's the long-term care piece, which we haven't talked about, and the disability piece. What I do think and what is clear is that when you have big public policy problems, you have to have state experimentation. And you're not going to see that in Medicaid till we resolve the ownership issue. And that's why I think it's the first step of reform. And let's let them experiment. Let's see if Florida's got better answers than South Carolina. Let's see if New York can come up with something. Microphone.
I wonder if you agree with me that more and more doctors are going to, as the time goes on, opt out of Medicare. And if you do, what is going to be the impact on the debate of that fact?
The question is, you know, doctors opting out of Medicare. More doctors opt out of Medicare than they did 10, 15 years ago. The Center for the Study of Healthcare Change does nice studies on this. One of the recent studies suggested that about 30% of doctors refuse all or some Medicare patients. When you actually look at the data, one discovers that most refuse just some Medicare patients. It's not as bad as the study might initially suggest. I think there are limitations because the government's very coercive. Can't work in a hospital that receives any federal funding and refuse Medicare patients. So there are natural limitations. But look, Doctors are frustrated about the bureaucratization of care. Doctors are funded by the wage and price controls of Medicare. I don't think the way out of that is more wage and price controls, and yet that is the direction we're heading in unless we do something else. I think we should have market pricing for healthcare, and we'll see what doctors' fees really ought to be instead of what some committee of Congress decides they ought to be.
I'm not as current on the statistics as I used to be, but I believe that I think the number was about 10 years ago we spent 14% of our GNP on healthcare, and one third of that was spent on often heroic efforts in the last 6 months of life. So, and I think those numbers are roughly right, about a third of healthcare spent in that way. So we're spending about 5% of our economy on those last 6 months. Do you have any reaction or comment on that and how? I think in Canada you just wait in line and then you don't get the health care that we would provide to the elderly. But what is your reaction to how much we spend on that particular part of the health care bill?
Sure. We now spend more than 14%, as I alluded to earlier. It's in excess of 16%. How much we spent last years of life, most of that work is actually drawn from studies from the 1970s, which unfortunately I don't think are so relevant today. I would suggest to you that expenditures at the end of life aren't necessarily meaningful. There's a very clever gentleman by the name of Wenberg out of Dartmouth who does comparisons, last 6 months of life of Medicare spending between those, for example, at Mount Sinai Hospital here in Manhattan and Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and they find that here in Manhattan we spend like three times more, and patient satisfaction is actually lower. I don't think the cure-all is going to be looking at just at that last 6 months of life, but again, I think there are some values issues that we need to tap into and what we're doing and the amount of intervention we have and how many of us actually have living wills and so on. I think, though, the more important task is to recognize globally the problems with the system and put in more market forces. I don't think it's just the last 6 months of life that's so problematic. Again, these are old studies from the 70s, and medicine has very much changed since then.
And talking about this subject, you know, one of the things that I've talked about with Kate Baker, who's on the President's Council for Economic Development, or economic something or other, was that the American population seems to be addicted to healthcare. Sometimes you can, and you as a psychiatrist might appreciate this more than most, but because we've gotten so much free healthcare over the years, we've grown to expect it and have grown addicted to it. And some of that is evidenced by going into a family, open the refrigerator, and on the door of the refrigerator you'll find three or four unused bottles of amoxicillin that are on the door. Some parents giving, if one child gets sick, they'll give them an antibiotic and put prophylactic antibiotic for the other two children because they're going to catch whatever it is that this person's got. And I suggested that there's got to be a way economically of breaking that addiction, to which she said it's a very heavy political lift. And mostly my opinion is do it through taxation, but do you think that because it is an addiction, that the population has got to bottom out in terms of the crisis that's coming in order to be able to pay for things?
I think pay for things is the catchphrase you've just made mention of. Are Americans addicted to healthcare? I'm a doctor. I probably see things a little bit differently than perhaps you do. I think Americans are very used to getting a lot of healthcare on the cheap. I don't know if those same value judgments that you've suggested would apply if people paid more out of pocket. And I definitely think that more and more employees would rethink their health benefits program if they knew it was the difference between getting a raise and not getting a raise. And in these coming 7 years, more and more will have to make those decisions. I do acknowledge, though, as you've suggested, there is somewhat of a cultural issue. For so many years, health insurance has been something done for you, right? You go to the doctor. You drop down your insurance card, somebody else pays your bill, your employer, right, or his insurance carrier. That's got to obviously change in terms of the way we approach that. But I don't think that's a big cultural change, as some would suggest, especially when the choices are between managed care, socialized medicine, and individual choice and competition. I think, in fact, many people would be more inclined to take control of their health care. So I'm not quite as pessimistic as the people in the White House. They're obviously very pessimistic these days. No text messaging problems with me.
David, many of the solutions you put forward depend in part on getting public policy changes through our legislators, our state houses, governors, what have you. I'm interested in you getting your views on things that can be done by the private sector or by private individuals. And let me suggest one that was put forward several times by Newt Gingrich and the folks at Siemens Medical, which obviously has an interest in the outcome, and that is using information systems to extract further productivity gains. For example, using information to codify the basic data that hospitals and doctors share but somehow lose to get medical mistakes eliminated through using more intensive information systems to regularize the information flow from patient from beginning to the end. And huge productivity gains theoretically have been can be achieved throughout the system, but have been achieved in various hospitals in Long Island, in Kansas, and other places. What can you say that is in the domain of individuals or in corporations, irrespective of the choices that legislators make?
Look, I like all of these ideas that get talked about so often. More information technology. You know, when you go to the supermarket, they scan your item. Through a satellite, it goes to the head office that an item is getting depleted. Right? You go to your doctor, he writes in a chart, then he mails it to a friend, only slightly more sophisticated than the days of the Pony Express. I like evidence-based medicine, too. I like all of those things that get so much discussed. I think the question for us is, why is it that we have so little information technology with healthcare, right? Why is it if you walk into Brooks Brothers, they've got better equipment than most doctor's offices do? And I think the answer, besides the fact that Brooks Brothers is a darn well-run store, the answer is that the incentives have been all wrong, okay? So I think if you get the incentives right, things will change very dramatically. I mean, another aspect of that is, you know, health information available to consumers. As I alluded to at the beginning, I could get so much information on hotels, not so much on hospitals. That will change when consumers get more involved in healthcare, right? So going back to your initial question, which is what can the private sector do, what can companies do, is roll as many people as you can in consumer-driven healthcare and support them. Because the more people who enroll in these plans, the more demand there is for information, and as a result, the more information there will be. The more hospitals will turn around and address some of these deficiencies. Went to Milwaukee the other day, discovered I was short on cash, went to the ABM, withdrew a wad of cash, well, not really that much, got a printout, okay? I don't bank within 500 miles of that bank. God forbid if I had had chest pain and went to the local hospital, how long do you think it would have been before they had had my medical records? How long before they would have known my previous conditions, my allergies, what medications I'm on? That is not, in my mind, a symptom of a lack of creativity within health insurance and healthcare. It is a symptom of the incentives being all wrong. Get more people in consumer-driven plans. Lots of things will change.
I enjoyed that talk a lot, and I think it gives rise to optimism. When people start talking your way, people will start to listen. But you mentioned health savings plans. As these are used more and they catch on and they encourage more preventive medicine and self-help, don't you see that as one of the ways that the cost will start coming down because people will be paying for their own health care cost?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there's much that could be done on the preventive side since there's so little in way of systems approaches to illness in America. I think one could see huge changes, right? You have heart failure. You take your health savings account and shop around to four or five heart failure clinics and pick the best one with the best results. So, I mean, I think you'd see that rise somewhat. I'm sorry. Summarize your question again. Oh, right, preventive medicine, right.
Paying for better medical care,
Look, every time I go to a speech, somebody inevitably stands up and says, if we just got that smoker to stop smoking when they were 20, we'd save $80,000 by the end of life. Don't you think we should invest more money in preventative care? I think there's huge limitations to that, okay? As a doctor, it breaks my heart to say this. But most people make bad choices, and they're aware that there are consequences of those bad choices. It's just that when people in their 20s, they're immortal, right? I don't do primary care. My wife does primary care. But when I did do a little bit of primary care, if I sat down with a teenager who just started to smoke, and I said, you know, smoking causes cancer, I never had this reaction. Oh, my God, you're serious? So it's great to talk about preventive health care. And if we, you know, only put more money forward, everything would be fine. There are limitations to that. I think people would manage their illnesses better. I think you'd have more creativity on the provider aspect. But I also do think that even if you have a consumer-driven American system, rich in capitalism, devoid of regulations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, people are still going to smoke too much, drink too much, and eat too many high-fat foods.
You talk about competition. Do TV commercials tie into competition? I don't know about Canadian television, but American television is filled with advertising for pharmaceuticals and hospitals and right. medical procedures. How does right. that fit into your ideas?
It does and it doesn't. I mean, I think competition is a good thing, and I think advertising is a good thing. But I think what you see, particularly on the pharmaceutical end, is not that they're competing because they've got necessarily better products or more innovative products, but just that you're hopelessly overinsured, right? That you've got stomach reflux. You have a choice between a $7 a day pill, a 30 cent a day pill, or just changing your diet. And I think too many Americans say, hey, you know, why not the Cadillac? Somebody else is paying. So I think transparency and information are even more important. Right now, we don't really have competition with regard to healthcare, right? We have competition with regard to health insurance, for sure. And we have competition with regard to people trying to attract your overinsured body to their clinics. It's a little bit different than the innovation and the competition we see in other aspects of healthcare. Sorry, other aspects of the American economy.
Just one question. I don't understand premiums for people. Someone who smokes inevitably costs a tremendous amount of money eventually. They get emphysema and all sorts of problems that way. We have obesity in the country. It's tremendous. These people end up with heart conditions, blindness, and so on.
Right.
Why don't we raise the premiums for these people? Why should I have to pay for someone who's obese, who's going to get sick, and cause all these problems? Instead of a normal premium, double or triple it. Money is what makes people think, and this would prevent them to some extent from continuing their crazy lifestyle.
Well, I mean, that is the problem. That is the inevitable problem with pooling risk, right? You sit in an office, and three cubicles down, there's a woman who smokes, is constantly eating. You're subsidizing her health insurance. I think, on the whole, there's probably good benefits to pooling risk as well. But undoubtedly, that's part of what's going on. But I also think that, you know, you see some insurance plans becoming a little bit more creative about things, encouraging preventive medicine, encouraging people to take a little bit more ownership on their illness. Ultimately, though, I think we have to accept the fact that healthcare in America is about taking sick people and making them healthier rather than taking people who make bad life choices and making them better souls.
You propose capitalizing the system, capitalism, and obviously I don't think you're going to get any argument in this room and many others that that's where we have to go. Unfortunately, it seems to me, the road to reform is through the Congress. What's happening in healthcare is a parallel to what happened in the pension area. It's overregulated. Recently, we had a new bill, the Pension Protection Act, which is going to reform the pension system and make it safer, more secure, and protect PBGC and all that at the same time. But what's happened is we got a bill that's now going to destroy what's left of the defined benefit system. When Congress deals with any of these problems as a reform, supposedly to produce a beneficial result for the society, it worsens the problem. How do we get to your nirvana or your utopia when we got to go through the Congress?
It's an unusual circumstance I find myself in now having to defend Congress. I think you're quite right. Congress gets a lot wrong, and I think a lot of us feel particularly the last couple of years have been a missed opportunity. But as Sherlock Holmes once said to Watson, when you rule out the impossible, everything left, no matter how implausible, is suddenly possible. This system can't go on, okay? We know that. I suggest 7 years out. You can debate me. Maybe it's 10 years out, okay? Rule out what we don't want. Managed care, socialized medicine, everything else is self-evident. Congress doesn't necessarily speak in those terms now. Soon enough, they will.
I would agree with all of your 5 points. I wonder about the one you didn't mention, which was tort reform. Is that because you think it's a red herring and it doesn't have capacity to save resources in the system, or because it was outside your main thrust of your analysis?
The latter. I mean, undoubtedly, lawsuits have a huge coloring on the way medicine is practiced in the United States and the way people receive medicine. One has heard over and over the term defensive medicine. I mean, that's not part of the solution. Lawsuits also have a profound impact on other aspects of American medicine, including what's in your medicine cabinet, right? I mean, so much of what's available has to do with what drug companies think they're going to be sued about, which is why Vioxx probably was a reasonable drug for some people, and you'll never see it again in the pharmacy, okay? I think tort reform is part of this, but look, I'm just a doctor, not a lawyer. I leave this up to much smarter people than myself, including some of my colleagues at the Manhattan Institute.
I know you said in your talk that you don't like rationing, but I was wondering what you think of the UK's National Institute for Clinical Excellence, which has the power to just refuse to pay for drugs and procedures that they feel can't pass a quality-adjusted life year metric, and to what extent that might be able to save resources if we did something similar here.
Sure. I think NICE, as it's euphemistically named, is not nice. I think it's a terrible thing when government bureaucrats are picking and choosing what drugs are good for you. And I don't think that's the approach we ought to take, and I don't think it's a particularly American approach. I do think that there is a role for NIH to fund more head-to-head comparisons of prescription drugs. I mean, psychiatry, NIH did a huge series of grants comparing antipsychotics and antidepressants, and I thought that data was relatively useful. For the most part, though, companies and scientists do that on their own. And what should be covered and what shouldn't be covered, I mean, that really should be up to you, and you should have more incentives to make those types of decisions, right? I mean, that's why we end up in this silly scenario, for instance, in New York State, where Viagra is covered even if you're a pedophile in a maximum security prison. I exaggerate only slightly. They reversed that decision in January. I mean, I don't think government bureaucrats should be picking and choosing what prescription drugs are good for you. I think you ought to, the way you ought to pick what sort of a car you like and what sort of a house you like. Unfortunately, today, I don't think there's a lot of good health information out there. I think that'll change with time, though. I look forward to today when I can go on hotels.com and pick a hotel, but I could also go to hospitals.com and get meaningful quality data. There are a lot of innovative companies out there doing things like that. Everything you know about healthcare, just to finish my point, is about to change. Listen, that's it in terms of questions and answers. I understand we're running out of time. I'm here and more than delighted to talk with you further. One of the amazing things about writing a book is getting out and being able to talk with people and share ideas. I've really enjoyed today. If I might make one final plug, Milton Friedman has described this book as fascinating, elegantly priced at just $20. Your niece and nephew think they want a fire engine for Christmas, but what they really want is this stocking stuffer. Depends how large the stocking is, I suppose, that will explain to you that there is hope for American healthcare. There are answers. We don't need to resign ourselves to the soft bigotry of low expectations. Thank you very much.